Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Well, the WTI is what I would call the North American or domestic pricing. And that's the crude oil in Cushing that is stored there and moves around various pipelines.
Dan Conrath is with StoneX talking WTI or crude.
The Brent crude market is the world oil market. You take crude oil, you refine it into gasoline, you refine it into diesel. And I think from a component standpoint with many of our clients here, gasoline costs, yes, they're there, but diesel costs, everybody ships through rail, everybody ships through trucking, everybody ships overseas, and there's a component of diesel in every one of those. So what happens in crude is a big driver of what happens for the ultimate end price that one of our customers pays for energy cost transportation.
This is Agriculture Today.
Who we are at the Kansas City Fed, which is part of the Federal Reserve System, which is, in fact, the central bank for the United States. But the way we are structured is to have regional offices scattered throughout the country.
Nate Kaufman is with the Kansas City Federal Reserve, speaking recently at USDA's Ag Outlook Forum.
So the Kansas City Fed represents seven states in the middle of the country, which, as you can imagine, have a very high concentration in agriculture, both by way of production, but indirectly other industries that would be tied to it. We also have a number of banks, as was mentioned earlier this morning, that would tie into agriculture. So it's an industry that we've paid a lot of attention to, and our goal in participating in conferences like this is that, yes, we want to be able to share what we're seeing from the Federal Reserve so that people understand that agriculture is being included in some of these broader discussions around monetary policy, but it also gives us a way to engage and learn from other people as well in terms of what people might be seeing in, with the outlook.
So what are the general conditions today?
Overall, I would describe an environment that credit conditions in agriculture have still been quite strong, quite solid. Even with some of the increases in financial stress, the slight reductions in repayment rates, and obviously the tighter profit margins that we're seeing with decreased commodity prices and elevated input costs, we still haven't necessarily seen outright large-scale increases in defaults that would warrant, I think, describing this as a crisis. Now, I will be quick to say that I'm describing a story of the averages here, and so there are definitely segments of agriculture that have been much stronger than others. We've talked a lot about cattle, and if for those operations that have cattle available to sell with the prices that they're selling, that's been one area of support. But we know that there have been certain segments, for example, in the crop industry where things have been a lot tighter. The ad hoc program payments likely will provide some additional support to this. So I'll preempt some questions by saying I think that this is something to pay attention to, because going into this year, if the expectation had been that we're seeing ongoing gradual increases in financial stress and then government payments limit some of that financial stress for this year, what does that mean when we're back here in February of 2026? So that will be, I think, a significant question. As I mentioned, farm real estate values, they carry an outsized weight when we think about the agricultural economy, in part because farmland accounts for such a large portion of farm sector assets and wealth, but also, as I mentioned, because many lenders will use those assets, will use that as potential collateral to extend operating debt, recognizing that that limits the risk that they would take on in terms of those that lending activity. The final comment, and I suspect that we'll address some of this more broadly with things that people might be interested in the Q&A, is economic growth, and not just here but globally. As I mentioned at the outset in that first slide, agriculture, like every other industry, has to exist within the sense of growth and opportunity, more broadly speaking, in the nation, in the U.S. economy and globally. So the things that happen, whether we're talking about trade or labor or a number of other policies, to the extent that those things have effect not just on inflation, but also on the path of growth. And because the Fed has a mandate, a dual mandate for maximum employment, growth, and inflation, then those things have implications for interest rates. So back to where I started when I was a kid and thinking about interest rates, that's to emphasize that point, is we know that interest rates have been an additional headwind for many operations, and that's something I think that will also be a question in the year ahead.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
H.R. 1326, the DOE and USDA Interagency Research Act, is a perfect example of government of efficiency.
On Monday, the House passing a DOE-USDA Interagency Research Act, Texas Representative Bruce Babin.
This bill directs the Department of Energy and the Department of Agriculture to share their resources and knowledge to achieve common mission priorities. DOE and USDA already have a successful track record of collaboration in topics such as the energy-water nexus, invasive species control, wildfire risk mitigation, and biofuels. Through the expanded interagency agreement authorized in this bill, DOE and USDA can tackle additional complex research challenges, such as genomics-based research and rural energy development and grid modernization.
Michigan Representative Haley Stevens.
Thank you to the gentleman from Oklahoma, Mr. Lucas, again, our former committee chair, for reintroducing this legislation alongside the gentlewoman from California, Ms. Lofgren, our ranking member of the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. The Department of Energy and the United States Department of Agriculture have a long-established history of partnering to address multidisciplinary research areas like biomass energy development, sustainable aviation fuels, and various methods for improving clean energy development and deploying that development in rural America. So H.R. 1326 is going to codify and strengthen these cross-cutting and collaborative research and development activities between these two departments, the Department of Energy and the Department of Agriculture. This bill positions these agencies to overcome future international competition challenges while accelerating the production of biofuels, renewable chemical feedstocks, and conversion systems that can support clean energy technologies and, of course, rural economic growth.
Co-author of the bill, Oklahoma Representative Frank Lucas.
This bill allows the Department of Energy and the Department of Agriculture to work together to improve how we grow our food, fiber, and fuel in America. I introduced this bill in the last Congress with the help of the ranking member of the Science Committee, Ms. Lofgren. The measure passed with a unanimous support through the committee and by voice vote on the House floor. As a farmer and rancher myself, I'm proud to sponsor this bill, which will help us address cross-cutting research challenges that will advance crop science, maximize carbon storage, enhance precision agricultural technologies, and much more. DOE and USDA already have a successful track record of collaboration to mitigate invasive species, to modernize the grid, address energy-water nexus, develop biofuels, and improve agricultural operations. DOE has some of our country's most advanced computing capacity, as well as world-class research facilities and a depth of scientific expertise. These resources can be used to support the work being done by America's farmers and ranchers, ultimately strengthening our agricultural production. This bill before us today is a smart, bipartisan legislation that codifies the partnership between DOE and USDA, ensuring that they can continue to work together on these inter-industry challenges.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Some of the things are going to be, calves are higher, but again, a higher price bull, you have higher price calves because that cost goes back on each cow that you breed.
So what is the cost of a bull? Randy Sainer is Extension Program Leader, University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
So comparing the bulls to see what they add. So if you're buying a higher price bull, is that bull going to increase your weaning weights? Is it going to improve your carcass quality? Is it going to keep your cows in the herd longer if you're a cow-calf guy, meaning they have more longevity? And so those are all things you got to consider. And, like weaning weights, we've not seen a lot of increase in weaning weights in probably the last 20 years. Part of the problem is the cows just can't get enough quality nutrition or enough extra nutrition to put more milk and to put, get those calves bigger. So that may not be one thing I would look at. But longevity of the cow herd is really economically important, in a, especially in a ranching operation. Now, growth of a calf and how it marbles and stuff is really important to the feeder. So putting some of those things in there might make your calves bring more if you're a rancher, or if you're finishing them all the way out, you can improve your bottom line by selecting for some of those. How much you can spend is the question, right? And I looked at a $7,000 versus a $9,000 bull, just selling those calves at the market. And it took me, it cost me about $4,000 on a 300 cow herd to do an extra cost to buy that bull for going from 7,000 to 9,000. There's a lot of bulls going over 9,000. So you need to think about that. Now, if that is just keeping everything neutral and that's using the price of calves today, okay? But if you tend to, if you get cattle that are higher grading and you get a higher profit from that, if you're selling them at the feed yard, it's probably, you know, maybe worth it. But you need to put that value in there. And that's what this bull calculator helps us do.
And then there's the idea of using AI.
When we AI, if we time breed AI so that we can breed all the cows 1 or 2 days, that just takes the labor from heat checking, right? And then because you're going to get 40%, 50% bred, depending on the herd, some, that means you don't need as many bulls, right? Because you've already got almost half of those cows bred. So you can get by with a reduced number of bulls. So AI would be one thing that maybe could really benefit you, especially if you're having to buy higher priced bulls, and the semen you could buy is pretty reasonable. But remember, there's costs with that. It's about $40, $50, depending on with all the, by the time you get the injections, set them up for AI and the semen if you don't buy a real high quality bull. I mean, you can still buy a good bull for probably $50 with all those things included. You could also spend more money if you wanted to. You could collect the bull you bought that's high priced. The challenge I see with that is if it's a young yearling bull, it's kind of unproven. And I don't know if I would want to AI 100 cows to a young bull that's unproven. And so that's a thing you might want to think about. Instead of doing it maybe the first year, if the bull turns out really good, then you might collect him and do that in later years. But using an unproven bull, may not be your best answer, but you could buy one from an AI company, and then you buy less bulls too, or from a breeder also.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
North American prices up until 10 years ago, what happened here, what happened in Europe, what happened with Russia, Ukraine in 2022, that affected our price for gas. Even though we couldn't necessarily ship as much gas in 2022, 3 years ago, our price went from $2 to $10 because of European prices going from $10 to $100.
Dan Conrath is with StoneX, talks LNG, liquefied natural gas.
And that was a result of a more of a world pricing market due to the shipping of LNG. Before that, our price wasn't what it was. The golden age of LNG, and this is interesting, we are the OPEC of the LNG world market. There's three main suppliers, Qatar, Australia, and the United States. We're either one or two. It's Qatar, U.S., Middle East, U.S., Middle East, U.S., goes back and forth. The difference with LNG is you can talk about LNG growth, but to start a project, to finish that project, to get it going is a 3 or 4 year process. And let's say 4 years ago, we had maybe 4 BCF a day, 4 billion cubic feet of gas exported every day, 4 or 5 BCF. We're at 16 BCF now, to give you a reference point on that. Maybe that was 6 years ago or something. In the next 2.5 to 3 years, we're likely going to be almost double that. Not quite, 28 BCF. That's a lot of growth. And the Trump administration is going to use that LNG as a incentive slash weapon slash whatever you want to call it. And if you want liquefied natural gas, a stable supply from a stable country, you're going to work with the United States. And I think LNG is really the big, you'll notice commodity markets on these tariffs discussions have fallen recently with the Trump, Canada, China, Mexico, even the EU. The one market that has moved higher during this whole discussion is natural gas. And that's because we've got a lot of it. We're producing a lot of it. The golden age of all that being built is coming on board the next 2 or 3 years. It's a viable tool for us to become OPEC for the next 5 to 10 years of supplying the world.
You can have it, but can you move it where it's needed? Phil Flynn is with the Price Futures Group.
Yes, we need more pipelines. We need more smart regulation, right? And, you know, we lost valuable time, I think, under the last administration, you know, where they thought that, you know, liquefied natural gas was not good for the environment, which is absolutely ludicrous because it's actually much better for the environment than the alternative, right? And the United States, with their production prowess, has the ability to, you know, feed the world with natural gas, and we've lost time. There's going to be a lot of competition in the world. But, you know, we talk about natural gas being a bridge fuel to the future, but I think it's more than that, right? I think it's a fuel that not only can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you know, in this country or around the world, but it can actually power the economy of the future. Because if we look at where the economy of the future is, look at copper today. It's rocking today. Power centers and data centers, they're going to need a lot of energy. Some of that's going to come from nuclear, but the reality is a lot of it's going to come from natural gas. And so the United States really needs to get their infrastructure in place to take advantage of what's coming, and it's going to be coming in a big way.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This bill passed the House with unanimous support last Congress. That's because smart, bipartisan legislation rarely faces opposition.
Texas Representative Bruce Babin.
I want to thank former Science, Space, and Technology Committee Chairman Mr. Lucas and Ranking Member Loftner for once again leading this effort.
Co-author of the legislation is a farmer, member of the House Ag Committee from Oklahoma, Frank Lucas.
I've introduced this bipartisan legislation in the past two Congresses, and on both occasions the measures passed the House by voice vote. I reintroduced the bill this Congress along with my colleague and friend, the ranking member of the Science Committee, Ms. Lofgren. It updates the reporting requirements for NOAA's Office of Commercial Remote Sensing Regulatory Affairs so that Congress can monitor how regulations are impacting the growth and improvement of the commercial remote sensing industry. Congress first authorized the licensing and regulation of commercial remote sensing space systems in 1992. Since then, the industry has become a crucial resource in a number of industries, including agriculture, finance, trade, energy. Remote sensing uses data collected from satellites to produce images of Earth. This imagery and data has a number of important applications. It can allow farmers to improve the crop production by more efficiently applying water and fertilizer. It can inform the future commodity prices by actively monitoring weather and crop health. It can also improve our ability to prepare for and respond to natural disasters by instructing floodplain mapping, tornado tracking, and drought monitoring, topics that are all front of mind for all Americans, but especially those in my home state of Oklahoma. Commercial remote sensing can also be helpful in humanitarian relief efforts and monitoring treaty compliance, among other national security and foreign affairs applications. This technology provides us critical information for a number of fields. As the industry is constantly evolving and growing, we must make sure that Congress is receiving timely and comprehensive reports to accurately evaluate how regulations are affecting the state of the industry. The Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act of 2015 established a reporting requirement from the Department of Commerce on the status of commercial remote sensing, licensing, and regulation. That requirement expired in 2020. H.R. 1325 will reinstate the reporting requirement and keep Congress informed of agency actions, their impact on licensees, and the state of commercial remote sensing industry. Mr. Speaker, H.R. 1325 is a simple, bipartisan bill that will help ensure that the United States remains the global leader in commercial remote sensing industry. I want to thank the ranking member, Lofgren, for joining me in advancing this legislation, and I urge all of my colleagues to support this bill.
And Babin added,
"These joint efforts advance clean energy and agricultural technologies and promote rural economic growth. As global competition intensifies and our adversaries seek to gain an advantage by feeding and clothing the rest of the world, it is vital that we strengthen and preserve this interagency collaboration to keep pace through innovation. This bill will do exactly that. We have two world-class agencies, DOE and USDA, conducting research, so it only makes sense that we ensure they are both at the table to coordinate on a wide range of topics."
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Let's start with Brazil, the world's larger soybean producer and exporter.
What do South American crops look like? University of Illinois ag economist Joanna Calusi.
Brazil's soybean crop is projected to hit a record 6.1 billion bushels, a 13% increase from last year, according to the National Supply Company. Some private consultancies are estimating the harvest could reach 6.2 to 6.3 billion bushels. Overall, yields have been strong across the center-west, southeast, and northeast regions due to plenty of rainfall. In Mato Grosso, Brazil's larger soybean-producing state, the harvest is complete with an average yield of 58 bushels per acre, a 25% jump from last season, according to the Mato Grosso Institute of Agriculture Economics. Meanwhile, Brazil's southern states have faced challenges due to dry conditions, especially in Rio Grande do Sul, the country's southernmost state. There, yields are expected to average just 37 bushels per acre, following a hot and dry weather in January and early February. Despite that, Brazil's national average yield remains strong at 52 bushels per acre, 10% increase from last year. Looking at global trade, Brazil is on track to set new export records in 2025, driven by strong supplies, a favorable exchange rate, and a potential impact from a new trade war between U.S. and multiple trading partners. The Brazilian Association of Vegetable Oil Industries projects that Brazil's soybean exports will reach 3.9 billion bushels this year. Now let's shift to Argentina, the world's largest exporter of soybean meal and soybean oil. Argentina's soybean crop is expected to remain stable at 1.8 billion bushels, according to the Buenos Aires Grain Exchange. While yields may be lower, an increase in planted area has offset some of the decline. This expansion is due to farmers planting less corn acres as the crop has suffered from corn stunt disease last year. Argentina's crop faced drought stress in January, raising concerns about production. However, rainfall in late February brought some relief. Key agricultural regions, including La Pampa, Buenos Aires, and Entre Rios, received good precipitation, helping crop conditions. Harvest is set to begin in April. By the way, during the summer growing season, Argentine farmers received some positive news. At the end of January, President Javier Milei reduced export taxes. Soybean meal and soybean oil tariffs dropped from 31% to 24%. Soybean grain tariffs fell from 33% to 26%. This reduced export tax will remain until the end of June and could be further reduced afterward. Lower export taxes combined with a more stable economy environment could increase technology adoption and exports in the coming years. In summary, current estimates project that soybean production in Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay for the 2024-25 crop season will reach 8.4 billion bushels, marking a 90% increase from the previous season. With this production, global prices will likely remain under pressure, at least through the first half of the year.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
USDA's March Cattle on Feed report shows another year-over-year decrease in cattle inventory in feedlots. USDA livestock analyst Mike McConnell starts with placements.
The biggest thing to note was the number of placements during the month of February, 18% lower than a year ago.
Yet McConnell says one thing to keep in mind with that placement tally.
February of 2024, we actually had a relatively high placement number. A lot of that was driven by the fact that we had some pretty strong winter storms in January of 2024.
With placements down 8%, from last year. A combination of smaller domestic cattle inventories and fewer cattle imports. Slower marketings due to higher prices translates to slower slaughter pace to start 2025. In total, 11.6 million head of cattle were recorded in feedlots as of March 1st. That inventory down 2% year over year. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.